The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Well, good morning. My name is Karen Moore. I'm the Director of Curriculum and Instruction at Grace Academy of Georgetown. That's a little town just north of the great city of Austin, Texas. And you are here for the study of literary analysis via Latin literature. So if that's not what you're eager to study for this morning, you might want to look around. But this will be a great discussion that will look at both literature and Latin, English, Latin, and how we can really bring those two studies together using our Latin programs and our Latin studies to reinforce our students' study of literature in general and their study of writing as well. So as we begin, if you will, please join me in a word of prayer. Lord God, we thank you so much for this day, for this weekend, for this conference, for this opportunity to come together with like-minded colleagues, friends, parents, students, who are all seeking to glorify you in education, training up young minds and hearts that they will follow you and seek your truth in the world around them. I pray that you bless this time, and I pray that you would bless these words, that they would give some measure of blessing and inspiration and encouragement to those who hear them. In the name of Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. Well, about a couple of months ago, I had an article published in Classis on this very topic. And its intent is to exhort teachers of Latin to go beyond the grammar studies into the study of literature from the mindset of literature, looking at Latin as literature and setting it in the author's original language. And so what I would like to do today is really to combine a little bit of philosophical and a little bit of practical, intermingling the two wherever I can, because I do very much like to exhort a philosophical idea, pedagogical practice. But for me, when I come to these conferences, I really like to have something to walk away with in my toolbox of how to implement and put into practice these ideas as well. So I'm going to go back and forth from this article into some practical examples and expound upon the paper that I wrote by way of anecdote and example. As a Latin teacher, I've often asked about how many years one should teach Latin and for what purpose one should teach Latin. And it's an ongoing conversation, I think, within our classical schools, and a very healthy one for us to all be iron sharpening iron and looking at those purposes. And the answer really comes down to the end goal or the telos of language study in your school. And that's going to look different in each school and each region. But for me, when I'm asked that question, I feel that the end goal is to study literature. If you suppose that the purpose is to improve vocabulary or just understand grammar better, then a couple of years is certainly enough, two or three perhaps. But I would argue that there's a really great treasury to be gained in studying a classical language long enough and thoroughly enough to study the riches contained within the original works and the original compositions of Latin literature, and not just that of classical Greece and Rome. But we see that the study of Latin continued long past the fall of Rome, through the Middle Ages, past the Renaissance, and into the modern era. And not for the sake of morphology and derivatives, but because educated men and women wanted to study the writings of ancient Rome and her authors, her masters of poetry and prose, in order to imitate those writings and in order to further their own writings themselves. These works were not merely words on a page, but works of art, thoughtfully constructed from carefully chosen words, arranged with skill to wield power and stir the heart. To read a translator's modern interpretation is to see through a glass dimly. to read the work as originally penned is to meet with the author himself. Students of such literature read not just for pleasure's sake, but also for the purpose of learning how to craft such work themselves. And I think we see that in our literature classes. I would argue that we're not quite there, all of us, in our Latin classes. We study our vocabulary, we study our grammar, and then we'll want to read a work, but it's almost as if we're just saying, well, we've read the work. And it's almost, I like to liken it to art. I've done some past lectures on the comparison of art and Latin. And I like to liken an author's craft with that of an artist. An artist is carefully going to choose color, a medium, whether it's art, oils, acrylics, or watercolor, or sculpture, whatever their medium of choice is. They're going to choose colors that portray light. The type of brush that they use to create their brush stroke. You know, Monet looks very different from Van Gogh. They're two different purposes. And if you go to an art museum and you want to just stand back and look at the piece from afar, you're certainly going to appreciate that piece of art, and it may make an impact on you. But if you're a student of art, that's not enough. You're going to want to not just see it in a book or see a reproduction. You're going to want to go see the original and get as close as you can, as close as the museum guards will let you, right, to really study that piece and see, well, what did he do, and how could I use that when I create art? So I really want to approach this presentation and literature in that same way. Yes, we want to be able to read for pleasure's sake. We don't need to parse every work that we read. At the same time, when there are things that strike us, when there are things we put up as masterpieces of literature, let's get in them and discuss what makes this so powerful, what makes this so great. Considering a literature class, Herodotus, we're probably not really wanting to imitate him. We're probably just wanting to get some historical information. Mark Twain, Jane Austen, not so much fact. We're looking for their style, for the way they wrote, for the way they were able to influence and sway people and make points about their social, cultural experiences. So I would say the same thing with Latin. So I kind of mentioned the art already. But again, considering looking at a piece of literature as you would a piece of art and looking at how the author portrayed it. By reading these original pieces, students are permitted to sit at the feet of these skilled craftsmen and learn more diligently their skill and technique so their own writing may benefit. Such lessons are not learned simply by reading a work. They are learned through the careful study and literary analysis of these masterpieces. So then that begs the question, what is literary analysis? Literary analysis is not the summary of a work. All too often students and sometimes teachers misunderstand this crucial point. Upon being asked to write an analysis of the piece, most students will default into retelling a narrative of the piece itself, just summarizing it in a sense. The insightful student might point out some imagery or inference or innuendo, but for the most part, they're just going to restate what has already been said. This misunderstanding is so prevalent that on the advanced placement Latin exam put out by the College Board, the exam writers intentionally print this warning on each and every exam. Now, the stop sign graphic is mine because I'm trying to convey a point. But this is their exact wording, and they actually do put the "not" in all caps. And it's on every essay, every essay question they ask. Do not summarize the passage. And if you as a Latin teacher go to an AP training, regional, national, what have you, they will hammer this into your head. And they will say, we have so many essays that are exquisitely written, but they're retellings. They don't answer the question. They don't really get into analyzing the language. And we want them to go deeper. We want them to go further. And if you think about this, this is a great tool. I'm going to rabbit trail just for a minute, because again, we're not just talking about Latin, and we're not just talking about literature. We're talking about teaching students how to think, how to interpret. And so this skill goes beyond Latin. It goes beyond literature. It goes into apologetics. You know, what do you believe and why, and what's your source for that? So it goes a lot further. We're really training them how to look at words and speeches and all of that. A mere synopsis only retells the basic plot or main message of a composition. That's what this warning is against. Such summaries often overlook the subtleties of craftsmanship. How is the message conveyed? What makes it effective? Where is its power, its sharp bites for those invectives like Cicero? These are the types of questions an analysis of literature seeks to answer. Literary analysis is an exploration of a writer's interpretation or presentation of an event or an idea. Such analysis requires the study of literary devices, word choices, and syntactical structures the author uses to create an image in the reader's mind or solicit an emotion from within the reader's soul. Have you often read a piece and thought, boy, it just makes me feel this certain way? Why is that? Why does it evoke that emotion? The analysis seeks to answer the question why and for what purpose the author used such words and devices to create these images. These are the very questions we must teach students to ask as they read any work, classical or otherwise. We need to train these young minds to discern the design and intent of any author, and the literature of classical Latin is an excellent training ground. For the Romans knew that the pen was at least as mighty as the sword, and the man who knew how to wield its power could command legions. Why, therefore, does a master orator choose the words he uses? Why does he arrange them in a certain manner of phrasing? Who better to study for such purposes than masters of oratory and prose, such as Cicero or Augustine? Furthermore, students ought to learn how words can take shape on a page in order to create images and convey emotion, and how, in doing so, they can turn hearts. What teacher for these lessons could be who compares to the poetics of Virgil or Horace? These masters were the teachers of orators and poets for centuries. We see men like Milton, Tennyson, Shakespeare seeking to imitate them. These are the same teachers our classroom should invite to share the lessons of literary composition. Certainly, teachers of the modern era may choose English prose and poetry as their subject, and we definitely should be doing that in our literature classes. Or they may choose English translations of classical works, and we do study those in our literature classes, and that's a good thing. The warning must be taken to heart, however, that there truly is something lost in translation. Flavors of words and shades of meaning are lost when a translator attempts to reinterpret someone else's thoughts into his own and different language. Latin's loose word order allows for a juxtaposition of words that is often difficult to accomplish in English, thus almost a necessity, for especially in poetry, for them to reinterpret. Certain literary devices are also more commonly found in classical Latin than in more modern renditions of English. In short, there are some valuable aspects of Latin literature that are difficult, even impossible, to convey in English, and so we can't study those nearly as well as we can if we look at the Latin original. So as an exercise to demonstrate this point, I want to look at a couple of lines from Aeneid Book 4. This is on the AP syllabus exams. For those of you who do AP classes or preparing for those, you'll see this one here. And I'm partnering it with a translation by Dryden, who is a well-known translator. It's a published copy. You can go get it. And I think this is a great exercise for students, and I think it's a really good point for us, too, because Dryden is going to want to translate this into English poetic form. And so it's even more difficult, I think, with poetry than with prose to really convey all of that meaning because of the limitations of meter and rhyme and the different things that an English author might want as opposed to a Latin author and the word order that necessitates and such. So looking at this first line, we have Tyrio quardebat murce laina dimises ex umeris dives quae munera dido fecerat. Okay? And here below is Dido's translation, a purple scarf with gold embroidered o'er, Queen Dido's gift, about his waist he wore. Now I'm going to ask you what I would ask the students, and I expect an answer, so someone be bold. Comparing these two bits of poetry, where has Dryden altered from the original? Where has he taken a liberty? Do you notice something, anything that's missing or added? Yes. Excellent. Yes, Tyrion, the first word right up here. Okay, so Tyrion refers to whom or what? Yes. For those of you not familiar, Queen Dido was actually from Tyre in Phoenicia. I've read one source that suggests she was actually the niece of Queen Jezebel. There was a connection there. But she's from Tyre. She has relocated to Carthage because of some dysfunctional family issues. And so Carthage culture is really Tyrian Phoenician culture, especially at this early point. And that's why they were called the Punic Wars as opposed to the Carthaginian Wars by historians and by the Romans themselves. So we're calling it, it's a Tyrian purple. And Dryden leaves that out. What is the suggestion, perhaps, what is the importance of that word Tyrian? Yes, sir. Yes. That's one. That's good. Right. True. Yes. And specifically that it's Tyrian purple because of Dido's heritage. Now, I've often talked with people about you can't appreciate Book 4 of Virgil's Aeneid unless you understand the tension between Rome and Carthage. And in fact, in my humanities class, I taught 7th grade humanities where we read the Aeneid in English translation, and I actually did a lecture series and had them ring The Young Carthaginian by G.A. Henty beforehand. He says, you have to understand the animosity between Rome and Carthage. The three Punic Wars, there were life and death struggle, Hannibal, who nearly brought Rome to its knees, and there's this struggle here. So here we have the pater familias, the pater aeneas of the Roman race, and he's wearing Carthaginian clothing. And Dryden has left that out. It's Dido's gift. He says it's Dido's gift, but it's Tyrian. And I might liken this to students and say, imagine a poem that describes George Washington in Middle Eastern Taliban-type clothing. It would take them aback a little bit. It'd just be like, wait, that doesn't line up for me. Here's, you know, a nation that we're having some hostility with, and you're putting our patriotic father figure in that. This is not comfortable. And I think Virgil wanted us to not be comfortable with this. Here's another question you might pose to students. Okay, considering, again, social, political stuff at the time period. Is there another Roman ruler? Aeneas was legend, myth. Is there a Roman ruler known by Virgil that might have also been seduced by an Eastern woman? Who might have begun to wear Eastern clothing and adopt Eastern foreign customs? Exactly, Mark Antony. This was very fresh in their minds. You know, Augustus, Aeneas, this Virgil's work was all in an attempt to reconnect the Roman people as a people. They'd been in civil wars for so long, and the most recent one was Antony versus Octavian, who is now Augustus, right? And this struggle. And he went over there and he just shacked up with this Egyptian queen and he was wearing her clothes. And our great Mark Antony, who we all loved and admired, just he turned on us. And so I think Virgil's almost bringing Aeneas to the point of this, of, oh, look what danger our first father was in. He almost compromised here with Carthage. But of course, then we have Mercury fly in on the wings to kind of jar him. And I love it. Two lines later after this, Mercury calls Aeneas uxorious, which I think is a great word to pair with this line. Dryden's translation is a little bit different, but I always tease my husband. This is a word you need to know. But it literally means, you know, wife ruled, submitting to your wife. The woman's got you. You're just her. Well, anyway. So, depends on how far you want to go with your students, right? And what age they are. So, again, I think this is really great. Have them read the passage, but then put up Dryden's translation and say, what's different? Why? Why do you think Dryden left that out? I have this excellent book that I have read recently I would commend to you. It's A Concise Guide to Teaching Latin Literature. It was actually written before the AP exam changed. So it'll tell you in the foreword, these are all the AP authors, and they're not. But it's still great because I don't think our Latin literature classes should be limited to AP. And you have in here Cicero, Horace, Ovid, Catullus, and Virgil. And the gentleman who wrote the Virgil piece, Richard Thomas, he suggests that a lot of it had to do with Dryden's time period. The murice can be translated as a shawl or a scarf, which for a Roman would have been seen as effeminate clothing. In Dryden's day, the 1600s, that was a gentleman's clothing. So he's wearing a purple scarf, big deal. But for Virgil, it was Eastern, it was effeminate. It was not manly Roman. And so that's Dryden's interpretation. This is Mr. Thomas's interpretation, perhaps why Dryden left that out. Is to him, that was he didn't understand why that might have been as big of a problem. Now, again, that's his interpretation of it. But I think it's a good question to ask and a good question to have a discussion around. As this sample shows, great opportunity for this training in literature is afforded through the advanced placement courses in Latin, as created by the College Board. Indeed, literary analysis essays are required, and a textual comparison such as this would make great fodder for an in-class essay, even if it's just a short paragraph, to get them started down this path. You can start with sentences. It would be a shame, however, to wait until an AP class to do this. First of all, you're limited to Virgil and to Caesar at this point. You can do this much earlier in your Latin classes, and I would really encourage you to do that. You don't have to start with whole passages. You can begin with looking at just words like we did here, going to short phrases, and then longer passages. The answer, as you look at these, ask students why they think the author chose a particular word. And please keep in mind that there's not always one correct answer. You know, there's a lot of things that we can talk about. More important than the answer is that students really begin to learn to ask these questions. Because, again, this isn't just about Latin. It's not just about literature. It's training them how to think and how to discern. As passages are read aloud, consider together the arrangement of words. Start by looking at the words themselves. Exploration and discussion on the variety of meanings a dictionary offers, synonyms in both Latin and in English for that word. Ask students why they think the author chose a particular word. Why do you think he chose tirio to describe the purple? Why do you think he chose lina as the garment of clothing, the scarf? You know, why did he choose that word? As passages are read aloud, then consider the arrangement of those words. Word order for Latin is fluid, and the author has the luxury of placing words first or last for emphasis. He's certainly trying to adhere in poetry to a meter, but he still has more fluidity than English does, which allows for some great word pictures. Literary devices such as anaphora, asyndeton, and polysyndeton can be easily spotted by even the youngest students. Anaphora is the repetition of phrases. Asyndeton means there are no conjunctions. Polysyndeton means there are a lot of conjunctions. Those are three very easy ones, and there are things like alliteration, personification that they already should know. Let's take a look at this example. This is from Tertullian, his Apologetic. This is actually taken out of Latin Alive Book 2, a book that we use in seventh grade. And this one piece has a great example of asyndeton in it. Hesterni sumus et vestra omnia emplevimus. Urbes, insulas, castella, opera, conciliabula, casra ipsa, tribus, decurias, palatium, senatum, forum, sola vobis, reliquimus templa. So great use of asyndeton. There are no conjunctions. Our friendly English editors put in commas, which as students we all appreciate. A little bit of punctuation goes a long way. What would be the impact of this? I might say to a student, why do you think he left out all the conjunctions? What is the impact does this give this phrase?
Makes it more forceful.
Okay. He says it makes it more forceful. How so? How do you think it makes it more forceful? Yes. Okay. Kind of a staccato, repetitive. What is his main point in this? He says, we are of yesterday, and we have filled your everything, your cities, your islands, your fortresses, your towns, your marketplaces, the camps themselves, the tribes, the companies, the palace, the senate, the forum. Only to you we've left your temples. What is he showing? I think with this rapid fire staccato, it's like, look, guys, we're everywhere. We're everywhere. You can't go somewhere without seeing one of us. It's this instantaneous boom, you're surrounded. One of the exercises that I like to do with students in a discussion like this, because students, especially in this day and age, are so visual. And I remind them, you know, when Virgil, when Tertullian wrote, they didn't have video, they didn't have visual. This was their language. It was to conjure ideas and visions within your mind. So I said, if you were to make a movie, or if you were to paint a picture of this scene, how would you do that? How would you show that rapid fire, instantaneous surrounding? Yes. Okay. Good. He said cut scenes. Anybody else? There aren't really any wrong answers here. It's actually one that they really enjoy. They really have fun with. I ask this question a lot. Okay, how do we make this movie scene? And also because it gives them a visual image, when you're doing a full year of AP works where you have to take an exam at the end, it helps them too, I think, to recall the passages and the scenes and the storyline better. The one that came to my mind was the mirrors. You see this actually, this is a Charlie Chaplin movie, but I've seen this in a lot of different movies where Phantom of the Opera did this, the recent one, the more modern version, where he drops into a room and suddenly there's mirrors everywhere, and you get this feeling of being surrounded instantly. So that was mine, but again, there's no real wrong answer for this. But I just like to pose that question. It really gets them thinking about the impact that something has on them. As students advance past these basic literary devices, they'll begin to see how more complex devices such as hyperbaton, chiasmus, synchises may be employed to create emphasis or paint images. Here's another quotation. This one is, I took this out of our book 3 text with the Latin Live series. We use this one in 8th grade, and it's from Ovid's Metamorphoses. This is the story where Proserpina has been taken by her uncle, now husband, and her mother's looking for her. And so it's solus ab acasu, solus quaerebat ad ortus. And I love the juxtaposition of the words here, where you have quaerebat right here in the middle of this second phrase. And I see solus ab acasu, the sun from its setting, the sun to its rising, and then we have the verb right here in the middle of the second phrase. And for me, I take that, in my mind, I just see the mother. I see the orb of the rising and the setting of the sun here on the outside. And I see this desperately seeking figure right here in the middle of it. And I just think that's beautiful. I'm like, guys, you just don't see this in English as much. This is beautiful. Challenge yourself. How could you make a word picture with your words in a line of poetry? And ask them to. I've had them even do in their Latin class or even in their humanities class to write even just 3 or 4 lines of dactylic hexameter in Latin and see what devices they can imitate. The words here appear to mimic the orb of the sun around a confused mother. Such word imagery beautifully constructed here is difficult to imitate, but such discussions can cause students to begin to consider their own arrangement in words. As students' grammatical knowledge and reading ability increase, so also should the opportunity for literary discussion and deeper analysis. So move students from the discussion of words and phrases to whole passages. Begin to discuss and then compose essays on the development of characters and themes within a larger work. Train the students to cite passages, and this is something that my students have had a difficult time with. They really need some intentional training on how do you cite a Latin passage in a manner that will empower their own analysis of the literature they are reading. They want to make their citations oftentimes very separated from their work. And I say, no, what you want to do is you want to quote the author like you would quote somebody in English. Quote the author, just put the translation in brackets next to it, because that's what's required for a citation of another language. But make his words become your words. Use his words to convey the larger idea, reinforce the larger idea that you want to expound upon. Also, let me know where you found that information. You know, you're not just randomly saying, well, I think Virgil does this. I want you to cite, to show me, to prove to me. I have them over and over again. You have to pretend like I know nothing, and you've got to explain it to me. And don't just tell me what you know about a passage, but why and how you know it to be true. Again, this gets back to what I said earlier about this being great training for how to think, how to make an argument, particularly in apologetics. How often do we see students say, well, I know the Bible says somewhere we should or shouldn't do that. Okay, well, where? What's your basis for that? Don't just throw the word Bible at me. Tell me where. Tell me what your source is. So again, AP courses are a great place to do this. But again, I believe classical schools would do well to incorporate this valuable study into their own Latin literature classes. Creating such lessons and even whole classes within the curriculum to do this will allow teachers the opportunity to select works beyond Virgil's Aeneid, beyond Cicero's Gallic Wars, that are important to the cursus vitae of your school. At Grace Academy, for example, we require a full year of Latin literature in ninth grade. They have finished their grammar studies by then, and during this year, we study a range of authors from Cicero's Oratory all the way down to Isaac Newton's Principia, in which he explains the three laws of motion. And we cover a great breadth and depth of genres, authors in between. All original Latin pieces. I'd be glad to share that with you if you want to come by at the Classical Academic Press booth. I'd be glad to talk with you about that more in depth later. In such a class as this, the oratory styles of Cicero can be studied alongside those of St. Augustine or even Queen Elizabeth. St. Augustine's Confession may be read and compared to that of St. Patrick, written less than a century later after Augustine. The poetry of Catullus and Virgil can be compared with the poetry they inspired in Tennyson and in Milton. And allowing the students the opportunity to learn the art of literary analysis through Latin literature, we equip them with the knowledge and skill to engage in an exploration of texts both secular and sacred beyond any limitations of age, time period, genre. So that's really the philosophical, pedagogical part of it. And I've given you little snippets. But what I'd like to do now is give you a sample lesson of a larger passage in contrasting Virgil's Aeneid with Milton's Paradise Lost. And I have to tell you, I had a very difficult time selecting which passage I was going to use in the second half. It's like walking into a chocolatier store and saying, what do you want? And my friends at school will tell you, I just waffled and stressed over this. And I finally came to this one. My profuse apologies. I'm not going to get to Elizabeth and Cicero in this talk. I'm going to focus on these two. For the sake of time, I felt it was better to go deep with one. And the prologue for the Aeneid and for Milton's Paradise Lost, I think, are all passages very familiar to us. So I think we can have a better discussion based on those two, as opposed to something that maybe some have not seen. So we're going to look now at first the AP curriculum. Now, AP, some people love it, some people hate it. I completely understand both. And I think schools ought to be very careful in what classes they make AP classes. For us, the AP syllabus requirements for Latin made sense. For me, they complemented very well what I want to seek in training students for literature. This is from pages 8 and 9 of the syllabus of the course manual. I know it's very difficult to read, but I wanted you to see kind of this is comprehensive, and they talk about things over here such as vocabulary and word choice, not just the word itself, but the word in context. And they talk about, of course, grammar. You've got to know your grammar. They talk about, grammatical passages. They talk about syntax and comprehension. But I really wanted to zero in on these four points because I think they speak most directly to what I want to communicate today. The first one is that the student reads aloud Latin poetry and prose with attention to linguistic and artistic qualities. I do think the reading aloud is important because I think the more senses you use to learn something, the better you retain it. These were pieces that were meant to be heard, not just read. And it also slows them down a little bit. You read slower than out loud than you do silently in your head. And we want them to slow down. We want them to really hear and feel what's being said. Attention to linguistic qualities, talking about pronunciation, vowel quantities, accentuation of Latin prose and poetry. If you get into scansion, even the scansion of a line, is it quick dactyls? Is it slow spondees? Can really give gravitas or levity to a piece. Attention to artistic qualities, emphasis. Where's the emphasis? How is the phrasing constructed? The inflection or even the tone of Latin prose and poetry. I think about Cicero's In Catilinam, where he asks those rapid rhetorical questions. And you're like, okay, guys, is he really asking the question? No, he's being snarky. He wants to get across a point. Another point, the student identifies stylistic features in Latin poetry and prose, rhetorical devices and figures of speech, anapher, hyperbole, metaphor, rhetorical question. Some of these we talk about in our English literature classes. Some of them we don't. Anaphora, asyndeton, polysyndeton, I never heard about in an English class. I learned it in a Latin class. In English, they talked about repetition, but that was really it. So I think being able to have a deeper discussion of these is very valuable. The student identifies references to Roman culture, history, and mythology in Latin texts, such as the Tyrian purple, right? The student demonstrates overall comprehension of passage in Latin texts. And if you look at the sub-bullet point here, specifically a response to an interpretive question that reflects overall comprehension of the passage. So this is where you really get into literary analysis essays. And again, this is just a snapshot. I showed you the first slide to show you that this is just a snapshot of that syllabus. But these are some of the things we're going to be looking at. So again, I'm now going to go to the opening prologue, the first 11 lines of Virgil's Aeneid. I'm not going to read this one to you for the sake of time. So if you are having trouble in the back, you want to move up, please feel free to do so. But here are the first 11 lines of the Aeneid. And I would ask you, as I would ask my students again, to look at these things and start pulling out what jumps out at you stylistically. I think the first words are always going to be the very most important of a great work, right? So, arma virumque cano. Why does he start with those two words? What is he telling us? Yes.
A man of action, a man of arms, needs sort of the synecdoche of
action. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. He kind of sets his pace, and he talked about synecdoche in the arma, okay? Some people use the phrase metonymy as well. So he said a man of action, but arma is particularly what kind of action? Yes. So we're talking about a man, and we're a man of action nonetheless, and we're talking about a war. So these are the two things that Cano, I sing about. And then we explain who this man was, okay? Going down into line 4, so right down here, another great literary device in this line. One of my favorites, I didn't like it as a student. I appreciate it much more now as a teacher, but the transferred epithet, in saevae memorum unonis ob iram, so we actually have a little bit of almost a synchisis here, too, in this genitive here, saevae unonis, and then we have memorem and iram. But the memorying anger of savage Juno. And so I asked students, does anger remember anything? No, not really. So why does he put memorem there, modifying iram? Why is memoram modifying iram? If iram can't really remember anything. A little bit of a personification here too. Why did he do that? This is class participation time. Okay. Yes. Reminds me of the phrase, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Does she forget it easily? No, she'll never let you forget it. I never have that problem, for the record, just so you know. And he intermingles it too. So the point of who's really remembering the anger? Not anger. It's really Juno's problem. So he's got memoriam right there. You almost want to think that it's the memory of Juno by the placement. So beautiful how he just intermingles this to get across that idea that it's Juno's long-suffering anger that's the problem, okay? Another great one down here is the Altaimonia Romae, another great transferred epithet. The walls of high Rome. So he's making Rome high, where it's really physically, it's the walls, right? So this is a great one. So what does that do? I would ask the students, why would he have Altai modify Romae? Yes. Yes. So he said, elevates Rome to nobility. It's almost as if he's saying, Rome, enough said. It's Rome, people. So it's kind of that proud, lofty sense. So again, it's using those rhetorical devices to heighten those things. So that's looking at different words and word phrases. We can also look at the structure of this prologue and the opening of it to see what he included. Up here, again, we talked about how he states subject matter. Here's the subject, hero dude, battle. And then he gets into explaining about who the hero dude is a little bit. And then we have the angry goddess and how he suffered. And he suffered why? For what reason? Dum condret urbem, until he would found a city. So we kind of see this his calling, his destiny here. The Alban Fathers. And then we get down here to this very famous phrase, musa mihi causas memora. So here we have what essential component of an epic poem? Invocation to the muse. And he doesn't say much about it. Just muse, remind for me the causes. Every good Roman read the Iliad, read the Odyssey, we know the muse. Okay? Read all the Greek plays, we know the muse. And then he goes through, I love the kind of, it's not truly anaphora, but, well, it is anaphora. Quo numine laeso regina deum tot volvere casus, tot adire labores. So this queen, this angry queen, she forces a man through piety to do what? To go through so many misfortunes, to go through so many labors. And there's just this pathos, I think, this great sympathy we feel for poor pious Aeneas until he gets to book 4, and then we're just not happy with him. But they did this anaphora to really repeat, show the emphasis here. And then he finishes this little phrase by this wonderful line, Titane animis caelestibus irae. Rhetorical question, another great literary device. And this one's a little chiastic. We have Titane irae here on the outside, and animis caelestibus on the inside. And we have ellipsed the linking verb. Why did he leave out the linking verb? That drives students nuts. I need a verb! Why did he leave out the linking verb? Well, we can always say, well, meter. It's always a good excuse. Get rid of the verb. But he's also, I just think it's beautiful the way he wrote that phrase. You know, the can there be? Really, it's almost like he can't even utter that. Such anger in celestial minds. I tell students, when your mom gets really mad at you, or when you're really lost and confused in a thought, overwhelmed by despair and sorrow, do you speak in grammatically correct phrases? No. So I think phrases like this, or, you know, the quos ego scene in later on in book 1, are great just examples of what he's trying to show. So let me now go to the opening lines of Paradise Lost. Now, before I get too far into this, I want to commend to you this book by Derek Williams, and it's Virgil's Aeneid. This is 1-6. There's another one like it for 7-12, but I only needed this one today. But he does an excellent job in the first half of this is books 1-6. The second half of it is copious notes on books 1-6. And one of the things that Mr. Williams does that I so appreciate, and this was recommended to me by Carl Galinsky, who's a very well-known author and authority, on Virgil's Aeneid and in classical Rome, is that he really references a lot of the similarities, not only between the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid, but he references Paradise Lost in here a lot. And as a teacher in a classical school who likes to integrate with humanities, I love that. because this is where Milton derived his inspiration. He looked at the ancient epics, but specifically you see so many correlations to the Aeneid. And so he starts out with, of man's first disobedience and the fruit. There's his first line. I might ask a student then, how do you compare that to Arma Virumque Cano? What's the comparison there? Anybody want to venture? Exactly. I love how you just went straight to that. Forget the man. We all see the man. We know the man. Yes. And I saw that and I went, wow. But if you haven't read Virgil's Aeneid, do you really get that correlation? No. And again, I think to see that in the Latin too, how that's the very first word of the Aeneid, arms. And here it's the last word in the first line of Milton, fruit. This fruit, of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste. I almost feel like that's a little bit of a transferred epithet. Is taste really mortal? It was the fruit that held that critical mortality in it. So you could look at that. Let's see. Also looking at this next line, that brought death into the world and all our woe. We didn't see this in the prologue to the Aeneid, but when I read that, it reminded me of an important line in book 4, where Dido has made her fatal error, the cave scene. And whenever I read the cave scene, I tell students, if you're ever caught in a rainstorm, don't go in the cave. Run. You look in the movies, when do the Glover, it's always in the rain. So just beware of rainstorms. That's all I'm saying. So in this third line, brought death into the world and all our woe, it reminds me of this line, book 4, line 169 of Virgil's Aeneid, ille dies primus leti primusque malorum. That day was the first cause of death and the first of evils. And that's exactly what that's saying. It was that moment, that fruit, was the first cause of death, of mortality, and of evils. Yes, sir?
I think also maybe there might be reference. Think of that being a prologue. You think of the prologue of the Iliad, where it talks about Achilles' actions sent his soul to Hades.
Yes.
So,
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that Milton drew from all of them. So he's referring to Iliad in the opening prologue about Achilles sending souls to Hades. So yes, death and destruction in that one too. And Virgil really was imitating Iliad and Odyssey and components of that. But since this is a Latin lecture, I'm sticking with Aeneid. But great, great point. And I think that's something, if you're in a literature class, you definitely want to bring up. All right. The next one that I wanted to look at is he talks about loss of leading till one greater. Remember, Aeneas is roaming around until he accomplishes a destiny. There's a destiny, there's a purpose coming. Till one greater man restores and regains the blissful seat. And I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. Here we now get, if we want to look at thematic, here we now get to the invocation. Virgil's was basically 4 words. Muse, remind me the causes. And then he goes into all his questions. Look at how many lines Milton uses to describe the muse. And if you look at Iliad and Odyssey, they're fairly brief in their muse descriptions too. Why do you think Milton spent more time on that? That's another great discussion question. Why would Milton spend more time describing who the muse is? Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So a reader is not going to want to accept the muse as a Greco-Roman muse. They want to know who Milton's muse is. And so Milton is going to redefine who a muse is from a Christian worldview, which is what she said. Great discussion for a classical Christian school that wants to look at everything through a biblical worldview, right? So that's a great discussion to have too. And then she goes down here. He goes down here, continues on. The shepherd who first taught the chosen seed, Sion. I thence invoke thy aid to my adventurous song, that with no middle flight intends to soar. Now here is one of the places, I think, where Milton touches on that art of juxtaposition that we see so often in Latin authors. notice where the word middle is. It might be a small detail, but it struck me. He could have said that intends to soar with no middle flight. Now, there might have been a metrical problem there, too. Also, for students, litotes is one of their, my students jokingly call it litotes, but they love litotes, right? They want to oversimplify it as a double negative, but it's really defining things by its opposite. So you can talk here about another similar rhetorical device between Virgil and Milton, the litotes. You could talk about how interesting it is that he puts middle flight in the middle of the line. So it's just an artistic detail, not perhaps as profound as some, but it's beautiful nonetheless. If I go back now to, this is the next 20 lines, no, I'm sorry, the next 10 lines of the Aeneid, just past the prologue. And here I want to step back and I want to look at theme and structure a little bit more. So we have here the description, We have the description of the ancient city of Tyre. So we see the Tyre again, right? And Carthage. I love this. Carthage contra Tiberina. They're opposite geographically, but there's something else you know a Roman is thinking of. They're opposites. And so we're setting up this, you know, fierce in war. Here's Juno and all of her problems, you know, how much she loves Samos. And then we have here, you know, how she hoped to favor Carthage, but there was a progenium from Trojan blood that would dare to overthrow the Tyrian arches. Right. So we see this setup of the enemy and the hostility. And this is part of his remind for me the causes. What was it that made her so angry? Why was she so upset? What was her grudge? Why was this fury scorned? And so we talk about that hostility, and then we talk about the progeny coming. And then I bolded this just because I love this phrase. In all of the Aeneid, this one just makes me smile. Sic volvere parcus, thus roll the fates. And I tell this, can't you just see Clotho and her sister sitting there going with their little thread? That's how we roll. I'm just like, there's nothing under the sun, guys. You think that's a cute modern phrase. It's ancient. Virgil had it long before you. So, that's just kind of my funny side note. There's nothing really important about that. I just like it. So then moving on to Milton, here we have, here we have, again, another example of anaphora. Hic ilius, here were the arms of that woman. Here was her chariot. So, again, it's saying, here was her chariot. Here were her arms. This was her favorite. So here we go into, this is skipping down to 127. So I've skipped a little bit of Paradise Lost. But because this juxtaposes, I think, more nicely with that second half of the prologue. Say first, for heaven hides nothing from thy view, he's still talking to the muse, nor the deep tract of hell. Say first. So there we have a little bit of anaphora, another stylistic device. What cause moved our grandparents in that happy state from their creator and transgressed his will? Who first seduced them? So we get down to the quotes that we were seeing in Virgil's prologue. What angering what divinity? Upset at what? What rage caused the Juno to do all of these things? So we're asking here the questions, and then here we see the infernal serpent he it was whose guile stirred up with envy and revenge. You could just replace serpent with Juno, and you would have that same theme, that same idea in the first one. And then we talk about him deceived the mother of mankind. And we see here again this setup of the battle, this setup of the hostility. Because Milton, like Virgil, is beginning in media res. There's already his hostility present. Virgil's hostility is interesting because his hostility is a hostility that has and has not happened. He's talking about the Carthaginian War, but he's also talking about all of the mythological grudges that Juno has. And Milton's talking about, you know, what he'll get into later is why were the angels cast out of heaven, according to his epic. So I think thematically, you can go back and show the students these two passages. And I kind of stopped asking questions of you for the sake of time, but these are great questions you can ask them to look and see between these two passages. And again, use the original Latin. because you can see that a translation like Dryden's may or may not have that same power, and it's really not Dryden and Milton that we want to compare. It's Virgil and Milton that we want to compare. And we want them to see how these literary devices, how these rhetorical devices in ancient literature became the inspiration for later authors. And if Milton can imitate Virgil, why not us? Why can't you take some anaphora, some transferred epithet, some carefully chosen juxtaposition of words, and make some of these same imitations in your writing, students, especially those of you that have to write that thesis paper, or your creative writing, or poetry? Goodness, bring in some poetry. Another tactic I use, too, and I talked a little bit about the movies, but this one just jumped in my head, is artwork. A lot of times I'll ask students to interpret a passage of Latin literature, particularly poetry, by creating a piece of artwork. And say, I want you to try to tune into Virgil's mind, what he was trying to say. How would you interpret that yourself? So again, this is my exhortation to you to take Latin past perhaps what might be face value, perhaps grammar and vocabulary and derivatives, and to really dig into those original pieces of literature and the great treasury that awaits students there, not just in looking at the piece from afar, but looking at this masterpiece close up to see what made it such a great work, such a classic, and why and how should we seek to imitate that to improve our own writing. So thank you very much for your time. I think we have about 5 minutes left. No, Matthew says we have no time left. But I'm happy to take your questions, and I'll also be at the Classical Academic Press, due today, so that I'm more than happy to share some of these pieces of literature I have with you. Actually, let me close by saying that this comparison of Milton and Virgil is actually in, it's chapter 14 of Latin Alive, book 3, and we have those available there, too, so you can see them side by side. This book also contains a comparison between Catullus and Tennyson and Ovid and Shakespeare. So that might be something that you're interested in looking into for ideas and inspiration. Thank you very much for your time, and have a blessed day.